studies to really look at minocycline as an anti-inflammatory agent in spinocerebellar ataxia. If it's not going to be a cure, and if there are curative possible drugs in the pipeline, do you really want to tie up 300 ataxia patients for 5 years testing something that, you know, may in the end not be much better than what they can get over the counter on their own? And I think this is, you know, we're at a crux now where we actually have potentially curative drugs in development, and we have not a large number of patients who can participate in studies. This is not thousands of patients with arthritis. This is a very small number of very dedicated people who would, you know, run to participate in a clinical trial. You only do one clinical trial at a time. So if you've, you know, agreed to participate in a CoQ10 trial for 5 years, that means in 3 years, when studies of small inhibitory RNAs come out, you won't be able to participate. You'll have to drop out of the first study. So I think we're finally, fortunately, at a point where we can start budgeting what we do and make judgments about best drugs, best way to run trials, best ways to measure improvement, so potentially we wouldn't have to do a 3-year study. We could do something that we could maybe do in 6 months. So, CoQ10, Sue Hagen asked me to say something about that. This is all from Wikipedia, and I think it's for the most part correct. CoQ10 carries electrons. It powers up energy production in cells. It also is a free radical scavenger, so it protects other parts of the cell, membranes in the cell, from oxidative damage. So it's an antioxidant. Statins for cholesterol management can reduce serum levels of CoQ10 by 40%. So there is some interaction there. So some research suggests that if you're taking a statin, even if you have no neurologic problems, you should probably be taking some CoQ10 to make up for that, because we need CoQ10 in our bodies. And there was also some evidence that was first brought to my attention by one of my patients with SCA1, who very early on, you know, was taking CoQ10, and he noticed that his statin drug for his cholesterol wasn't working as well. So I think there is some interaction that we do have to be careful of. It's not a free ride with any of these agents. Daily dosages up to 3,600 milligrams per day have been found to be reasonably well tolerated with no significant side effects. But, you know, the general feeling is that about 1,200 milligrams per day is a safe level if you want to try it out. So, does CoQ10 help protect the brain in ataxia? There was one published study in Friedreich's done by the British group looking at 400 milligrams per day of CoQ10 combined with 2,100 international units of vitamin E, and that's far above what is recommended in the United States for vitamin E intake. They thought that there was some improvement in measures of mitochondrial energy synthesis. They thought they saw some slowing of progression of certain clinical features, but not all of them. And they thought that there was some improvement in cardiac function. So I think for people with Friedreich's, CoQ10 with, you know, a modest amount of vitamin E, maybe 400 to 800 international units, is a very reasonable strategy if one can't get idebenone, for instance, over the internet. And the dose of CoQ10 was just 400 milligrams, so it was much lower than what we saw in the previous slide. So there is some evidence that CoQ10 can be beneficial in Friedreich's and in other mitochondrial diseases. It is beneficial in conditions associated with CoQ10 deficiencies. So you can get a CoQ10 blood level and find out what your level is. There was a study done in Huntington's disease at 600 milligrams per day, which did not produce significant slowing in functional decline. So they went ahead and organized, and this is where I got those numbers, a study of 1,200 to 2,400 milligrams per day, tying up 300 people with Huntington's for 3 to 5 years, which, given the pace of good drugs under development, I really think is a waste of resources on many levels. And, you know, is CoQ10 going to do anything significant for the dominant disorders? In Parkinson's, it seemed to have an effect. And I think the key to whether antioxidants like CoQ10 are going to be helpful in a small or larger way is, you know, what the role of the mitochondrion is in that disease. Is it a minor part of the pathophysiology, or is it a major part? Medical marijuana. How many more minutes do I have? When I sat down to write these slides, again at the behest of Sue Hagen, I turned on some Fleetwood Mac. It was very enjoyable. But, and I think this is also becoming something that we're going to have to deal with at some point. Cannabis contains 483 compounds. 80 of these are cannabinoids. And this is the basis for, you know, the scientific and medical interest. They are appetite stimulants, and those of us in college in the 60s can attest to that. But they're also good for suppressing nausea, muscle spasm, and they may have some anti-pain effects as well. There are six important cannabinoids that have been studied. I think the one we're most familiar with is tetrahydrocannabinol, THC. In 1990, they found out that there are specific cannabinoid receptors in the brain. And there are neurotransmitters or chemicals that are active in the brain at those receptors that are very similar to what you see in marijuana. Very interesting. What was our brain thinking when, you know, this is very interesting. So it suggests that the use of cannabis probably affects the brain in the same manner as some natural process that's already going on in there. They have been found to have antioxidant properties. It's very interesting, and there's some research going on looking at them, their effect in, you know, age-related disorders, stroke, inflammatory disorders, autoimmune diseases, and neurodegenerative disorders. So there is research going on looking at this. Acute effects while under the influence can include euphoria and anxiety. Concerns have been raised about long-term use. But the data in following, you know, long-term users of cannabis, you know, does it increase the risk of mental health disorders, or is it that people with certain mental health disorders, you know, may seek, you know, the euphoria or whatever from the cannabis? There's long-term, you know, concern about its effects on memory, but there are so many confounding factors that, you know, I think the long-term effects are really not clear. Usually detectable in your system for 3 days to 10 days after use, and heavy users can have positive tests for up to 3 months after use. So you should remember that medical marijuana, you know, and now recreational marijuana in Washington and Colorado, you know, approved at the state level, but it's still illegal federally, so that, you know, if you're planning on applying for a federal job and they do drug testing, you probably don't want to have used that in any time that might relate to that. So, you know, the NAF annual membership meeting in Denver in 2 years should be really interesting. There is a synthetic cannabinoid that was made, Marinol or Dronabinol, that was approved in 1985 in the U.S. For nausea and vomiting associated with cancer chemotherapy, and then later received additional approval for loss of appetite associated with AIDS-related weight loss. So, you know, certainly for some of these uses, you know, for nausea, for weight loss, Marinol and a couple of other drugs similar to it are in wide use. So exercise, however, always helps, and I think we should remember that. That there are a lot of drugs available, things we can use for symptoms, things that may boomerang and cause more problems than they're worth. There's a lot of things in the pipeline, but bottom line, the one thing we do have ample proof of is the role of exercise. So you need to have questions answered. NAF and its network of ataxia specialists can help with all of these questions, including a more recent one. How can you get access to diagnostic testing and treatment? And I think with changes in healthcare funding and insurance company policies, you know, that is one of the more common questions I get is, you know, my insurance doesn't cover a visit to you, Dr. Perlman. How can I continue to see you? My insurance is denying a trial of IVIG. What can I do? And I think we need to work, you know, as more things become available for these rare diseases, we have to educate, you know, the people that are going to be providing care and the insurance companies that are going to be paying for it. And we have to make sure that people do have access. So this is the group that we have at UCLA that is involved in neurogenetics research and clinical care. And again, I wanted to thank National Ataxia Foundation, some of our supporters of our grants and research activities, and also the patients and families.
An Irishman was flustered not being able to find a parking space in a large mall's parking lot. Lord, he prayed, I can't stand this. If you open a space for me, I swear I'll give up drinking whiskey, and I promise to go to church every Sunday.